From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Booksellers and book lovers won't let their guard down yet, but so far it seems like books, paper books with pages and spines and covers, are going to make it through the digital revolution. There are all kinds of reasons for this, but here's a new one, at least it was for me. Books are sticking around because of the brilliance of their design. That's what David Glertner told NPR last week. He's a professor of computer science at Yale, and he called the design of books an inspiration of the very first order. Books, the professor says, are made to fit human hands and human eyes and human laps in a way computers are not. So, there you go, another reason to feel like you're still part of the in crowd when you pull out a book at the beach this summer. Now all you need are a couple of suggestions of what to read, and for that, we've got you covered. It's our annual summer book show today, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a saying that comes from the theater that I think about from time to time. Enough is too much. The idea being, it's nice to leave an audience wanting more. And whenever they're thinking, okay, that's quite enough, you're dead. The truth is, whenever we do one of these book shows where we have our book experts here to recommend titles for the holidays or the summer season, we never seem to get to the sweet spot. And not because we've done too much. There's never enough time, and there are always stacks we just don't get to. So we're going to jump in right away today. Today in the program, our annual summer book show. This is how it works, of course. Our usual group of experts are with us to suggest books for the summer downtime. We'll be putting this list, the ones we get to and the ones we don't, on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Betsy Burton co-owns the King's English Bookshop on 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. Welcome back.
Thank you, Doug.
Catherine Weller with us, the new book buyer for Weller Bookworks. That's at Trolley Square in Salt Lake. Kat, welcome back.
Thanks, Doug.
And Ken Sanders with us, the owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake. Welcome back to you.
Always a pleasure, Doug.
As I said, I don't want to dilly-dally around,
okay.
but I do. There is that question I do want to ask because it's been a while since we've talked. How are things going? What are you seeing? What kinds of trends or what kinds of books are people interested in these days?
Well, first, the biggest trend is that independent bookstores are on the map. We are having a renaissance. We talked about it before, but it's just burgeoning now. They're actually writing about it in the New York Times, which is, you know, means we're really there. Yeah. And it's about how many books we're selling and also about just increasing locations, you know, more and more independent booksellers.
Because you used to get that story that, you know, oh, another one's going out of business.
Yeah.
Another one, now we're headed the other direction.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, how many years in a row is it now, Betsy, that the membership of the American Booksellers Association has gone up?
It's actually 5, and it's only hit the news the last 2 years.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, and bookstores are up 20%, some of them, and 40. I mean, it's just astonishing.
Yeah. You knew it, Ken, right?
Oh,
I know it. I knew it. You know, God and books is not dead. Not only are there more new bookstores all the time, but there's new old bookstores as well, because reading is up again. Reading is cool again. And I think there's an analog to the vinyl albums of our youth.
Absolutely.
They were dead a decade, 15, however long ago it was. I'm not good on chronologies. And vinyl for the past 2 years has outsold CDs. All the new young bands and young people who didn't used to know what a record player was have them and play vinyl now. And I dwell on that because I see some real parallels to our book world.
In what way, though? Because it's not sentimentality or nostalgia. It's the tactile nature of the form?
Absolutely. Huh. Vinyl, it's a listening thing. And many, many people, I don't know that anyone's proven this, the sound quality of listening printing is better with the vinyl than any other form we've ever come up with before or since. And it's the same analog to our books. Mm-hmm. I mean, the tactile feel, as you said, holding this book. Well, maybe some people don't like to hold a big hardbound, but I sure do. I still take them on the planes with me.
The readers are up.
The bookstores are up.
It's not just tactile. It's that it is a technology that advanced with people and was grew with us and has reached this real level of perfection. So you get a warmth with listening to an LP, and you get a connection and immediacy with opening a book, with smelling the pages, with the way your eye can rest and move along a white page as opposed to whatever color screen you're looking at. I think it's a very apt comparison, and it's also a very apt comparison because of the millennials, the younger people. Everybody talks about how they're the digital generation, but you know, they're not the ones that abandon bookstores. It's us. It's my generation and the baby boomers.
Yeah.
They're the ones abandoned physical books, and they're coming back, but at
they
the
are.
Same time, the millennials are coming up and getting a disposable income now, and they're using it on things like books and bookstores. They like the authenticity, the immediacy of that physical experience. I think that community connection is very important for
younger
people.
Well, that's sort of the segue to the other part of this, and I know we'll get to books, so hold on, but I'm interested in that local component. I'm wondering, that seems to be a part of this, too.
It's huge, and really the local movement, which started, you know, in the late 90s when the chains came, has just burgeoned, and it is like the environmental movement. It's taken it's across the country, everywhere. Hundreds and hundreds of cities have local movements,
yeah.
And the youth of America really cats right has, you know, a lot of us have too, but young people are sort of the way we are. We're about the Vietnam War in our era. You know,
yeah.
They are activists for community, and they volunteer at Local First, and
yeah.
They are fully aboard, and they care about their community.
It's part of the social justice movement.
Yeah.
It's about they're riding bicycles, they're reading books, they're listening to records, and they care about things local, whether it's whatever it is they're consuming from food on down.
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Books. Betsy Burton, we're going to start with you.
Okay, and I'm going to start with fiction. I'm going to start with The Book of Aaron by Jim Shepherd. Speaking of books, produces wonderful, beautiful works of art, which is another piece of that conversation we were having. They are books of art. This is just a stunning book. It takes place in the Warsaw Ghetto, and the main character is Aaron, a young boy who, as the walls close in, becomes feral, runs with a group of feral boys, and they'll do almost anything to find food to take home to their families. So on the one hand, they're just little savages, but on the other hand, they have a kind of moral imperative. So a very interesting world. And then as, of course, in Warsaw, the they called them the Yellow Police, were Jews who policed the Jews in the ghetto. And so they're trying morally to figure out how to deal with these traitors and with the Nazis. He finally finds a kind of safe harbor with a very famous, his name was Janusz Korczak. He's a doctor. He was a doctor who was world famous. And he had an orphanage, and everybody assumed they would be safe there. I won't tell you what happens. But it is one of those books that is so blistering and so unforgettable that it just kind of sears itself into your memory. And Jim Shepherd is just a wonderful writer. So The Book of Aaron is my first book.
The Book of Aaron.
Aaron. Then there is The Sunken Cathedral, and I couldn't bring it along because it isn't out yet, but it'll be out in about a week. It's by Kate Walbert, who wrote The Gardens of Kyoto and the book of short stories about women. The name is escaping me. Anyway, she is a wonderful writer, and this book takes place in an art class in New York. One of the artists, Helen, is writing about submerged cities. So there's kind of an air of doom over the beginning of the novel. The two main characters were old friends during World War II in Europe and lived through all kinds of horrors. Now they take this art class. So there's a community in the art class. The teacher is another main character. And then Marie, who really is the main character, her neighbor is another So that begins to bring in their community. And this book is about past and how the past affects the present, the two friends and the influence of World War II, also about their immediate present art and how it can and the community of the studio. But it's really about community itself, and then it's about, you know, and how it connects us. But then it's about all these pieces of ourselves that are so interior that we never share them with anybody, and the memories that never surface but are so much a part of our interior life. It's just a beautiful, beautiful book, and I loved it. It's called The Sunken Cathedral. It's by Kate Walbert. And then another book that I loved, and it's very different than these two, is Muse by Jonathan Galassi. Jonathan Galassi is one of the senior editors of our day in the publishing world. He works at Farrar Straus, and this is his first novel. And it's about a young man, kind of a coming-of-age story. This young man becomes friends with a bookseller in upstate New York, and she puts him in touch with a publisher. This publisher is a womanizing, raging narcissist, but very able publisher in New York. And he goes to work for him. And he loves his new job. He loves books. He's just besotted with the whole world. But he most loves this poet, Ida Perkins, who is now in her dotage, but has known and loved every famous person in the world, including the two publishers. First of all, the guy that our hero works for, and then her own publisher. So he becomes friends with her publisher, and there's a kind of triangle that develops. And I won't tell you what happens, except that he does meet the poet, and this is just an incredibly dishy, funny, gossipy book about the literary world that is also very passionate about books. And I, again, just adored it.
Wow. Say the name of that title again.
Muse, and it's Jonathan Galassi.
Ken Sanders, you're up next.
Well, just staying on the theme of 1%, Doug, Joseph Stiglitz, who won the Nobel Prize for his book Price of Inequality, has a new book out called The Great Divide. And in this societal era where we might be frustrated with everything from our local politicians and legislatures to, on a large scale, nationally, Stiglitz gives us solutions, real-world solutions. I mean, come on, it's a book. It's called, you know, Business/Economics. Boring, right? But it's not. He's a beautiful writer, and he's giving us real-world, day-to-day solutions. It's not the 1%, for crying out loud. It's like maybe 1/10 of 1% at best that are ruling and controlling the wealth of this world and our resources. That's not right. It's shameful. And instead of just being outraged about it, well, what can we do about it? Stiglitz is giving us some real-time, real-world solutions to deal with some problems that affect us and the future generations hugely.
The Great Divide.
By Joseph Stiglitz. Locally, Edward Abbey's locally. There seems to be a spate of books coming out this year about Edward Abbey.
Yeah.
Well, I don't really think there's anybody that can tell me anything about Edward Abbey, frankly. But you had David Gessner on with his new book on Wallace Stegner and Edward Abbey, All the Wild That Remains. I love that title a lot.
Yeah.
Gessner gets into the psyches of both men and their own dislike, if you will, of one another and how completely different they were. And he also gets into some pretty serious criticisms of them both. I'll leave it up to the viewer to read the book himself or herself and decide if they're justified or not. And I'm not going to weigh in on that. But I found from hosting, as you spoke with David and we hosted him at the store, his book is it's very well written, and he makes some really good points. And personally, I don't think I'll get around to the other Edward Abbey books, but that's just me. For something completely different, hand-published, self-published. We have Ken Slight's Allies and Accomplices. This is a book in the raw. I mean, it's typeset. But this is memories and reminiscences by all of the legendary.
Is this new?
Yes. It's hand-published. There's a beautiful picture of River Runner Ken, a.k.a. Seldom Seen Smith, on the back cover. These are raw. Some of them are semi-literate from some of his pals over the years. And it shows us what a quote-unquote radical environmentalist like that doggone Ken Slight and the relationships he had with his so-called enemies, the late San Juan County Commissioner Cal Black and many others, and how once you meet Ken and get inside of his world and his embrace, you can't help loving him even if you hate his politics. And his own neighbors and friends down in San Juan and Grand Counties back that up with their testimonials in this book.
I see. How's he doing?
Ken's older than dirt. He's even older than me, but he's hanging in there.
Good.
And it's a wonderful book.
Say the name of it again.
Ken Slight's Allies and Accomplices.
Great. All right, Catherine Weller.
All right. So May 1st was the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Lusitania, which was one of the pivotal moments in America's entry to World War I and one of the great maritime disasters in so many ways. And there are a lot of questions about the Lusitania, why it was sunk, how it went down, why it went down so quickly, which makes it all wonderful fodder for Eric Larson,
who is
one of the best popular history writers we have, I think. He's brilliant at weaving the personal with the big, bringing details together about individuals that really bring to life a situation at hand, that really make you feel what is happening and make you feel more deeply the dread of what will happen. And there's a really wonderful setup that he does at the beginning of the book where he speaks about the people who are getting aboard the Lusitania after receiving the night before a cable from the German embassy that the Lusitania could not be guaranteed, its safety could not be guaranteed, and they couldn't guarantee that it would not be sunk.
So we're going to hear this section. Is this read by Eric Larson? Do we know? Oh, sorry, Scott Brick, I'm just being told, reads this section. What I love about this moment is it just seems to Vanderbilt impossible that this ship is going to go down. Here's a reading from Dead Wake by Eric Larson.
On Saturday morning, reporter Jack Lawrence went aboard as usual, but now with a particular story in mind. He carried with him a copy of the German embassy's warning. Lawrence stopped by the cabin of Alfred Vanderbilt and knocked on the door. Vanderbilt himself opened it, wearing an elegant suit with a pink carnation in one lapel. In the room beyond, his valet was hard at work unpacking a small mountain of baggage. Lawrence had tried to interview Vanderbilt in the past and had typically found it a pointless exercise because the man rarely had much to say. "Alfred Vanderbilt may have been a riot among the ladies," Lawrence wrote, "but in the presence of newspaper men, he was a shy and shrinking violet." Vanderbilt commented that there seemed to be an unusual amount of excitement aboard. "Lots of talk about submarines, torpedoes, and sudden death," Vanderbilt said. "I don't take much stock in it myself. What would they gain by sinking the Lusitania?" He showed Lawrence a telegram he had received after boarding. "The Lusitania is doomed," it read. "Do not sail on her." It was signed Mort. Vanderbilt said he didn't know anyone named Mort, but wondered if it might have been an allusion to death. "Probably somebody trying to have a little fun at my expense."
Mort.
Yes, good old Mort. Right after that passage, the reporter Jack Lawrence goes and speaks with Albert Hubbard of Roycrofter's press fame. The number of people, the number of items that were on that ship was amazing. Charles Dickens's copy of A Christmas Carol was on that ship, traveling back to Britain with a notable rare book dealer who lived in Boston. Aside from that, aside from learning about the people on the ship, learning about the people on the U-boat that sank the ship was just gripping. It was breathtaking learning about life on a U-boat, about this commander who had such a ferocious reputation, but who rescued a litter of dachshunds and kept them on his U-boat until he could get them to safety later. This is a remarkable book. People have been waiting for a long time for something to follow up The Devil of the White City, something as good as that. This isn't as good as that, but it almost is.
Deadweight, Eric Larson. It's Catherine Willer from Willer Bookworks at Trolley Square. Betsy Burton along with us at King's English, 15th and 15th, of course. Ken Sanders' Rare Books on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. A list of all of these books, the ones we'll get to and the ones we won't, will be on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a very quick break and be back. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's our annual summer book show. We have our usual suspects and our usual abundance of titles for all readers, the young ones and the rest of us. Catherine Weller with us, along with Betsy Burton and Ken Sanders. A list of all of these books will be on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Ken Sanders, back to you.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, Doug. He was alive as you and I.
We were talking about fever dreams during the break. Was this one of them?
They've come on, yes. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this. This is the centennial of Joe Hill's murder by the state of Utah, the old territorial prison in Sugar House Park. It was on November 19th, 1915. This is the centennial year. The Joe Hill Organizing Committee is hosting a whole slew of events that will begin in September. September 7th at Sugar House Park with an all-day-long concert headlined by Judy Collins and some others that we can't mention yet because we haven't finalized the contracts and the monies. We're still actively fundraising. But also a local son of Utah Phillips, Duncan Phillips, will be the MC. Kate McLeod and many other local musicians, singer-songwriters, and people from all over the country will be joining us that day. There will be also be the vigil on November 19th, also at the park. Bill Adler, that has probably written the most definitive Joe Hill book yet. It's not new or anything, but I want to quickly mention The Man Who Never Died by William Adler, that really, he gets so far beyond the Joe Hill Stegner novel because he had so much knowledge to access from. And another local lawyer that's really written a pretty gritty, hard-hitting book, Pie in the Sky, How Joe Hill's Lawyers Lost His Case, Got Him Shot and Were Disbarred.
So great subtitle.
This is hate subtitles, but that was a nice one.
It's a good one. Yeah. This is the year of Joe Hill, and it is, despite what we are calling it a celebration, because we're trying to celebrate the spirit of the IWW and this and the workers of the world, and it ties into the 1%. And
Wobblies is your theme today,
Wobblies,
right?
Yes. Yeah. I'm a little wobbly myself, guy. Quickly, locally, we've got a couple of there's a new era of Mormon history going on like we've never seen before. It's really, really objective. This is a very odd title.
Wait, say that again. There's a new era of what?
Of objective Mormon history going on, a real openness in scholarly work, being able to discuss things that were hidden and kept from anybody but academics and historians in the past, for us lay people. This little book is called How Desolate Our Home Bereft of Thee. Sounds like a Mormon hymnal title to me, title. But it's about the Circleville, Utah, little-known massacre of I'm not sure how many, but a huge quantity. This was during the end of the Black Hawk Wars in 1866. And some of the folks in Circleville, Utah, rounded up and coldly massacred a whole bunch of Paiute men, women, and children. We know about some massacres, but not this one. And emotionally, tellingly, this book is written by one of the descendants, participants of the massacre. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean about this new open sense of Mormon history. Not everything is goodness and light, and I think this little book proves it.
How desolate our home bereft of thee. Sue Jensen Weeks.
Thank you, Sue Jensen Weeks. And along that same theme, Mormonism Unveiled by Eber Howe was the first anti-Mormon book published in the 1830s. It has been issued in a beautiful new edition.
Wow, that's interesting.
From our local great Mormon book publishers, the folks at Signature Books. So it's a great new era in the days.
Wow.
And along the ideas of the concert, I'll just finish quickly with our our friend, I know Radio West does a lot with showcasing Utah musicians, composers, etc. And good on you for doing that, Doug. If you've never done Kate McLeod before, you ought to. She and Morgan Snow have got a new CD out called Triggers and Slips Presents Buffalo versus Train. Whole bunch of talented musicians on this book or on this CD.
All right.
Check it out.
Great. Thank you. Betsy, back to you.
Okay, so Kent Hariff died late last year, and we thought that Benediction was his final book. It was a book about death, really about his death, because he died a slow death, about how to say goodbye. A beautiful book. Kent Hariff, I think, if I had to pick a writer in the West who wrote about community better than anybody else, it would be Kent Hariff. Plainsong is one of the best books ever.
Ever, yeah.
Pure and clean, and he has written a new book. It came out. He finished it like just maybe a week before he died.
Did you know about it?
I heard about it just before he died, but not while he was working on it.
Hmm.
He had a little shed out back, and he would go out every day and try to work for as long as he could. And it is like Plain Song, this pure, transcendent book. It's like nothing else I've read of his since Plainsong, although I've loved all of his books. It's just absolutely wonderful. And it's based on a very interesting premise that we're going to hear about on the page. But just to set it up, there is a widow rustling around in his house. He's about 70 years old. It's nighttime. And there is a knock on the door. He opens the door, and there is a widow. He's a widower, excuse me. There is a widow who he knows only slightly. His wife knew her. And this is the scene.
Here's the scene. We should mention it's actor Mark Bramhall reading from Kent Hariff's Our Souls at Night.
Well, I'm just going to say it. I'm listening, Lewis said. I wonder if you would consider coming to my house sometimes to sleep with me. What? How do you mean? I mean, we're both alone. We've been by ourselves for too long. For years. I'm lonely. I think you might be, too. I wonder if you would come and sleep in the night with me. And talk. He stared at her, watching her, curious now, cautious. You don't say anything. Have I taken your breath away? She said. I guess you have. I'm not talking about sex. I wondered. No, not sex. I'm not looking at it that way. I think I've lost any sexual impulse a long time ago. I'm talking about getting through the night and lying warm in bed, companionably, lying down in bed together and you staying the night. The nights are the worst, don't you think? Yes, I think so. I end up taking pills to go to sleep and reading too late, and then I feel groggy the next day, no use at all to myself or anybody else. I've had that myself. But I think I could sleep again if there were someone else in bed with me. Someone nice. The closeness of that. Talking in the night, in the dark. She waited. What do you think? I don't know. When would you want to start?
You know, that's a nice reading.
It's a nice reading. And
because sometimes they don't work at all. That's nice.
It is, and he captures the softness of that scene.
Yeah.
And just one added word. So the whole book springs from that. But of course, they have pasts, they have families, they have dogs, they have grandkids. So this is much more complicated than it would at first seem.
Say the name of the title.
Our Souls at Night. And speaking of beautiful books, this is just a gorgeous book by Ken Harif, his last.
Catherine Miller. In your husky voice.
In my husky voice.
She's got a cold.
take a moment to talk about genre fiction. There is a thing about genre fiction. It gets poo-pooed a lot. But I find genre fiction to be very interesting. And there's always a genre du jour that seems to really capture the zeitgeist of the moment. Westerns, very long ago. In the 60s and 70s, it was the thrillers and the Cold War and the whole existential crisis of us and the Soviet Union. And now we have science fiction. Fantasy is its corollary, I'm sorry, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about science fiction, which I think really is capturing this moment of technological wonder and fear, both, where we're examining what it means to be humans in an increasingly technical world.
That is,
you
the
had Paolo
right?
Bagliacalupi on recently.
Yeah.
He is one of the great science fiction writers. There are fantastic genre writers who can hold up against any literary fiction writer, and they hit the same issues, they just do it differently.
Right.
So, to jump right in, Jeff Vandermeer, this is not new. He completed the Southern Reach trilogy last year. It published initially in three paperback volumes and then was published for the holidays in a bind-up in hardcover called Area X. This is a fantastic book that's written as science fiction, but with a naturalist's eye, if you can imagine. It takes place in Florida, down on in the Everglades areas, in a place called Area X. There was something that happened there. It is unnamed and unknown. The area is unpopulated by humans, so it's a wildlife refuge. People get sent in to research it, and they don't come back. Or if they do come back, they come back in mysterious ways. Each of the three books explores Area X differently. The first one is pretty much science fiction. It's four women who get sent in, four women scientists, and this is narrated by the biologist, who is the only one that lasts throughout the mission. It's called Annihilation. The second one is called Authority, and it reads like a thriller, and it is narrated by a controller. He has a different set of aspects and a different, more military perspective. The fourth book, Acceptance, is starting to sound like a 12-step program, pulls together in a very modern way four different narratives, bringing back both the controller and the biologist from the first book to explore that particular realm. It is a wonderful book. The attention that he pays to the detail of the landscape, the animals, and the insane mysteries in there, the low moanings at night, the deaths that are caused maybe by biology, maybe by people. It's incredible. The other one I couldn't talk about in an entire hour is Neal Stephenson's Seven Eves. He tends to write books that challenge my dyslexia. He's also the author of Anathem and RIMD. This is about one day it starts with a Utah scientist looking up in the sky and he sees the moon explode. It explodes into seven pieces. The next setup is a gigantic rush to prepare the space station for human survivors, for people who can get up there, who deserve to be up there, and the horrible hell that envelops Earth below. There are seven women who end up on each of the seven rocks who get to repopulate the population, which is diminished to below 200. And then 5,000 years later, they come back together to go on to another mission.
Wow.
It's very sciencey, but at the same time, there's a whole bunch of realpolitik. You think that the world gets left behind, but it doesn't. It's still politics and sacrifice and selfishness. It's a wonderful book. Neal Stephenson, Seven Eves.
We're going to take a break now and then head to our next round. It's Catherine Weller, along with Betsy Burton, along with Ken Sanders. A list of all of these books will be on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Another round coming when we get back from a quick break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. chatting away with our guests here. It's Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, Betsy Burton, Catherine Weller, Ken Sanders with us. It's our annual summer book show, and we're talking about titles, and we won't get to all of the titles they have with them, but don't worry, they'll be on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Okay, Ken Sanders.
We're going poetry, Doug. I want to give a
You always do.
We got to get poetry in. Poetry is our soul and our psyche. We need poetry. People who think they don't like poetry simply don't know good poetry.
Amen.
And they need to. Thank you, Betsy. Give a shout out to the folks at Sugar House Review. Michael McLean, currently with the Utah Humanities Council, has a big part of this. This is their number 10 issue. They have persevered. These are dozens of some of the finest Utah and regional poets we have, and they've got a brand new issue number 10 out of the Sugar House Review. Way to go, boys and girls. Mm-hmm. Also on a local front, famed word sinosopher Alex Caldiero has a new volume of poetry. I don't have it here today because it hasn't quite come out, but it's supposed to come out in June. Some Love by Alex Caldiero, Signature Books, once again. And also the Logan Notebooks by Rebecca Lindenberg, Mountain West Poetry Series. She is great. Yeah. Another, we have such a rich talent of writers, essayists, poets, singers, songwriters. We have an embarrassment of riches. So I want to end this segment with going retro. As, you know, I like to go retro. but I have an excuse. This book is relatively new, and it's in print. It costs an arm and a leg. But it's over 1,000 pages of the complete poems of Edward Estlin Cummings. I have one of these from my youth that has like dozens of, I don't think they had Post-its then, so, but I got some kind of bookmarks in them. That was pre-Post-it in my youth.
Why? Because of the erotica? Was that?
Oh, well, that I may have read some of those. Yes, he's one of our greatest erotic poems. I know you can't see blushing on the radio waves, but if I read my favorite poem in here,
we would all blush.
Us would be blushing, and the viewership too. So we won't go there.
Okay.
So we'll do a couple of quick ones. First, I'm just going to do a really quick excerpt from the Cleopatra poem, just to give you a taste of the sense of erotica that Mr. Cummings might have. Good old E.E. Cleopatra built like a smooth arrow or a fleet pillar is eaten by yesterday. She was a silver tube of wise lust whose arms and legs, like white squirming pipes, wiggle upon the perfumed Roman. That's the opening salvo to a three-page, very erotic poem. Okay, my favorite, one of my favorites, because you can't have one favorite. Buffalo Bill's defunct, who used to ride a water-smooth silver stallion and break 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 clay pigeons just like that. Jesus, he was a handsome man. How do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death?
Do you have that memorized?
One of the few. I memorized it when I was a kid, when I
still
had brain
cells.
Wow, you
didn't even look down.
Can't do that anymore.
Wow, terrific.
That part, that's gone. That feature is gone. It's been deleted from the upgrade. Okay, one last one. Picasso, you give us things which bulge, grunting lungs pumped full of sharp, thick mind. You make a shrill presence always shut in the sumptuous speech of simplicity. Out of the black unbunged, something gushes vaguely, a squeak of planes, or between squeals of nothing grabbed with circular shrieking tightness. Solid screams whisper, lumberman of the district. Your brain's axe only chops hugest inherent trees of ego from whose living and biggest bodies lopped of every prettiness. You hew form truly. Complete poems of Edward Estlin Cummings.
Great. Okay, Catherine. Weller, back to you.
All right, I'm going to do a few music books because there have been some great music biographies that have come out this season. The first is Words Without Music by Philip Glass. This is just a wonderful, wonderful memoir.
He wrote it himself.
He wrote it himself.
And he can write?
He actually wrote this book. He can do all kinds of things,
sure,
as you find out in this memoir. I love that he begins with his early life, growing up in Baltimore. And his mother told him as he was getting ready to go to New York, even though he had been initially rejected by Juilliard, she said, "If you go to New York City to study music, you'll end up like your Uncle Henry." Uncle Henry was an itinerant musician, and so this was not a highly desirable thing. And for a while, indeed, Philip Glass was like Uncle Henry. He did all kinds of things to stay alive. He was a taxi cab driver into the 70s. He had his hacks license. He was an unlicensed plumber. He was a furniture mover. But always he was a composer and a student of music and of life. So you get to follow him to Paris to study music with the great and indomitable Olaz, female musician there, composer.
He'll come to you.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, I'm leaking brain cells today. He goes to India and studies Gandhian politics and Indian history, learns about the salt-making trips.
Gosh.
He is everywhere, and it is a beautifully written book. Even though he's a formal, very formal and highly technical composer, this is a very chatty, informal memoir.
Which you wouldn't expect.
No, you wouldn't. It's stylistically so easy to read and so personable. It's a terrific book. Philip Glass, Words Without Music. The next one is a much more formal book by Kim Gordon, who is the bass player from Sonic Youth. And her book is called Girl in a Band. Sonic Youth was one of those hardest working bands in show business that never really got their due. And Kim Gordon was there for the whole thing. This book begins with an ending. Well, two endings. It begins with the last gig they played, which was in Brazil and was big and crazy, but also her marriage was utterly irrevocably falling apart at that point. She was married to Thurston Moore, one of the guitar players. Then it quickly pivots back to her childhood, and each chapter is relatively short, almost like a song, a little pain to her childhood. It's a very nice, brief, but concise exploration of her childhood. And then the book, about midway through, flips in tone when it gets to her music and becomes much deeper and more formal in its approach, even still. She is a cool cucumber. She's not a chatty and conversational person. But it's also a wonderful look at New York City in the 80s, the gritty, dirty, nasty city before Giuliani cleaned it up, that people loved and hated and loved to hate.
Yeah.
This is, if you were into alt music or grew up in the 80s, this is a wonderful book for summer reading for you.
Say it again.
It is Girl in a Band by Kim Gordon. Last out in paperback this season is Mo Betta Blues by Questlove. Questlove is one of the Roots, but
he's
now
great.
He's mostly known as
Jimmy,
the musical director
Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah. But he's a smart, smart man. And this is a book about music, about being a postmodern black man with postmodern blues, if you will. It is fun and dishy, but serious and political at the same time. I can't think of a lot of books where I've read about Prince roller skating and really serious discussions of race in America.
Wow.
It's called Mo Betta Blues, and it's by Questlove. It's in paper now.
Terrific. Betsy.
Okay, a little mix here of fiction and mystery. First, because it is summer reading, The Oregon Trail. Perfect 4th of July book. You're going to have to wait till almost then to buy it because it comes out the 30th of June. It's by Rinker Buck. I love that name.
You want to say it isn't real.
It can't be real, right? Well, and not only that, but he does the Oregon Trail in a covered wagon with a mule team, which is hard to imagine, but he doesn't. I have to start out by saying that he is very nutty. He's manic, totally manic, and he prepares, he gets the mules via email. He's not prepared for this trip. But as a child, he did this trip with his father.
Now,
not
he
the
gets
whole trip.
The mules via
Email. He never saw them.
That's beyond 3D printing.
He's a modern man.
and his in childhood, there were 11 kids in his family, and his dad took him on one of these trips, not the whole Oregon Trail, but he thinks he knows about this.
Yeah.
So then his brother decides to come. His brother has a dog called Olive Oil, and the three of them set out. You know, they have to negotiate freeways and rivers and all of this stuff. So there is the modern day, actually very harrowing tale of their trip, but he's quite a good historian, and it dips back into the actual journey of the Oregon Trail, and he's a great social historian. So, you know, as they're jettisoning everything in history along the trail, he compares it to modern-day Americans who do exactly the same thing, just throwing everything away, our gullibility. And one of the best parts of it was he said, you know, how the Tea Party loves to kind of co-opt the idea of the pioneering spirit. He said, actually, that was the greatest government giveaway in the history of our country. So he's it's just a joy to read. Then just briefly, a mystery.
Say the name of that.
Oh, I'm sorry. The Oregon Trail, An American Journey, Winker Buck.
Yes.
Okay, so there is a mystery. I'm so sick of Swedish mysteries. I'm so sick of serial killers, you know. And there is a new mystery by actually a first-time writer called Nightlife. It's David Taylor. And
you're a huge mystery fan.
I'm a huge mystery fan. It's what I do to stay sane. And picture, if you will, the 1950s, the days of Hoover, a New York cop who believes that he's there to watch the watchers, in other words, corrupt cops. He's walking along the street one night, and he runs afoul of Roy Cohn. He doesn't know what this means, but the reader knows what's going to happen next. It's a wonderful plot to do. His father runs a theater company, and there's a murder there. So there's an actual plot, but there's a lot about the whole Hoover shadow lurking over everything. It's just a great first-time mystery. Nightlife. It's David Taylor. Finally, Falling in Love, Donna Leon. Liquid heroin, I've said that 1,000 times. Her new one goes back to her first one, all involved in opera. Guido Brunetti and his family are wonderful. The plot is amazing. The opera is wonderful. And I can't recommend it highly enough, Falling in Love by Donna Leon.
Okay, we don't have time for a lightning round. I'm not sure I expected that we would get to that. We never do, so we're going to go on to a children's book round. But I wanted to ask you guys just quickly, and I don't want to spend a lot of time with it, but the Harper Lee Go Set a Watchman book. Have you thought much about it, what you think about that whole story?
We're dying to know.
Yeah.
You know, nobody knows anything.
This is a tighter lid than Harry Potter.
Yeah. So no one's seen anything yet.
None of us.
Well, if anyone would, it would be you guys. And you haven't yet, eh?
No, at BEA there was no, nothing. We're all dying to know. We can't imagine that it could be anywhere near as good, but you never know.
You never know. You never know. Okay. Let's see. Catherine, you're up first.
All right. My first one is a book from City Lights Publishing, the great publishers out of San Francisco who mostly do poetry, have done a children's book called Rad American Women, A to Z. This is a terrific book because for every letter you get a woman in history. A is for Angela Davis.
That's great.
And they make a real effort to be very broad in their scope. U is for Ursula K. Le Guin. It's across cultures, it's across boundaries. W is for Wilma Mankiller, it's across history. X is for all of the women who are unknown. It's colorful, it's got a great layout, wonderful brief histories of women who have been radicals, revolutionaries, and trailblazers. It's a beautifully done book. Rad American Women, A to Z. The next is A Chicken Followed Me Home by Robin Page. This is a book on chickens, nonfiction, for kids. It's all about chickens, everything you ever wanted to know. What will my chicken eat? How many eggs do they lay? What if I want to have chicks? On and on and on. It's actually really good. So if you've got kids and you've got chickens, A Chicken Followed Me Home.
And a lot of people do these days.
Oh, my Lord. Yeah, and they're all in the yard together, so you may as well get them that book. The last one is a wordless book called Pool by Ji Hyun Lee.
Oh,
it is beautiful. He's a Korean. It starts with a limited palette, a small boy in front of a pool alone, and then the hordes come, and it's bedlam. He swims down to the bottom underneath, finds another lone person down there, and they find color an adventure. It's quiet and lovely and just beautiful in its message and approach.
Oh, great.
It's called Pool by Ji Hyun Lee.
Mm. Betsy.
Okay, so I'm going to start with Echo by Pam Munoz Ryan, and it is the All the Light We Cannot See for kids. It's just an amazing
book.
Really? It is.
Now that's
absolutely
saying something.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. So there are three characters in it. It's framed by a fairy tale, and I won't go into what the fairy tale is about, except that music is a theme and there's a harmonica that winds its way through the whole thing. The first story of the three is about Friedrich, who's a German whose family the Nazis are closing in on, and they are a very, very musical family. The second story is about two American orphan boys, and again, they are adopted by someone, and music is the theme. And the third of all is Ivy. She's from a Latino family, but they're helping to maintain the house of some Japanese who are in prison in our country. Mm. And all three stories then come together at the end in this just blindingly good way that is all about music. It's such a beautiful read. It's called Echo by Pam Munoz Ryan. The second, nonfiction, The Boys Who Challenged Hitler, is about the boys. These are the boys who in Holland when you know, they were just tame Nazi puppets, these boys decided to start their own resistance, yeah. And this book is amazing.
Philip Hose, by the way.
Philip Hose, who's
yeah.
wonderful.
Yeah,
and this is a great piece of nonfiction. And just briefly, why they wear that, it's about clothes throughout history, little factoids about how they went to the bathroom in their armor and whatnot. So anyway, wonderful for everybody in the family.
Terrific. Okay.
Too much information.
No. Never too much information.
Ken, you don't have a lot of time, but go for it.
Okay. The Curdles by Robert Gooden, Doug. Fantagraphics, one of the great graphic arts publishers. This is maybe for a little bit older child because it's kind of in the dark fairy tale tradition of maybe Rainbow Goblins or Alexander and the Magical Mouse. It's beautifully illustrated, and as a graphic novel, it has wonderfully large, really well-rendered panels of sumptuous artwork. And it's this mom and her little girl. She wants the giraffe at the home, the teddy bear. The little girl throws the teddy bear out. It falls out of the car into the mud. He's lost. He's alone. The big truck splatters him, and it goes on and on. An owl picks him up to eat him, and then when he realizes he's inedible, he dumps him back in the mud.
Hey, you can keep talking until the music comes up. Keep going.
The dog gets him. Then he meets the strange cast of characters and gets in with them. And then his house, they take him back to the house, and the house has been overgrown. Something's taking over it and eating it, and it's alive, and it's going to consume the whole house and then consume them, and they have to solve the problem, and they work on it.
He doesn't have headphones, so he can't hear the music.
All music
say,
playing.
Say the name of the title.
The Curdles by Robert Gooden, and it's a great ending.
Ken Sanders. He owns Ken Sanders Rare Books on Sega East in Salt Lake City. Betsy Burton, co-owner of the King's English at 15th and 15th, and Catherine Weller with Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. Thank you all very much. We didn't get to a fraction of it, but that's okay. We will list them on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. It'll be up shortly today, so go see. There are lots of amazing books. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.